Stuart Onan has been publishing since 1987 with his many novels, short stories, screenplays, and nonfiction, especially one of the early books made into a movie. He's tried to figure out why people do the things they do.
One reason why I wrote Snow Angels is because something happened in Ithaca, in our town there. This woman said that her child had walked away in the middle of a snowstorm, and so everybody turned out to search for the child. And it turned out several days later that she had actually killed the child and buried it in the snow. And I thought, how does that happen? How do parents kill their own children? And yet throughout history, it's happened again and again. So it's human behavior, but I don't quite understand it. In that sort of fictional arena, I can try to get a little further toward understanding it.
We'll explore more of the writing life of Stuart Onan today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked to this prolific author while he was the 2017 Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence for UMKC's Creative Writing Program when we all gathered for the interview at the Kansas City Public Library.
Your being here also inadvertently ties in with the big read, because we had Tim O'Brien here and everybody was reading his book, The Things They Carried. And one of the two books you edited, The Vietnam Reader, which covers Tim O'Brien.
There's a whole lot of Tim O'Brien.
Everyone, if you haven't seen it, it's been out for 20 years.
Long time.
But it's amazing because you have fiction, you have poetry. You have letters,
the songs, yeah, everything. I want to sort of do big coverage, but of course it's just the American side. It's the American war in Vietnam. It's not the Vietnamese war.
Yeah. And you're looking a lot at the soldier.
How they're portrayed during the war and after the war.
And then you're covering it in waves, which is also interesting.
Yeah,
First wave, second wave,
yeah,
third wave.
Yeah, because there definitely were specific waves, and then they kind of ebbed there after about 1986 or 87. There, after Flannel Jacket, it kind of just sort of falls downhill a little bit. But you need to be like O'Brien and lighten it up a little bit, give some extra shades, and throw in some mirrors there, make it strange, make it odd, which he does. Provide that lift. Now, that lift of going after Cacciato, that lift of that wonderful story, speaking of courage.
When he was here, it was the most amazing reading that he did. It wasn't particularly light, but he was very good.
Oh, he's very strong. He's been touring with that book since 1990.
I know.
You know, which seems like a writer's hell.
Yeah.
In a way, it's like, you know, play the hit. We want to hear the hit. But I mean, obviously, it's changed the way that a certain generation sees Vietnam, because that's their introduction.
Let's talk a little bit about your background, because your first degree was in aerospace engineering, and you actually worked as an engineer
for several years. I was very mediocre. I was a very mediocre engineer.
Now, why do you say that? What makes a mediocre engineer?
I wasn't interested enough in it. I wasn't fascinated by it. I think I was fascinated already by reading and trying to learn how to write. So I would come home from work, and I was in test engineering. And when it was busy, I didn't have time to do anything. But when it was sort of slack, I'd spend, you know, some morning sitting in the bathroom reading War and Peace. Or I'd be downstairs, you know, at the test desk pretending to take care of things, just reading Turgenev or Flaubert and listening to New Letters on the Air on tape when I was commuting home from work and keeping my manuscripts with me so that I could work on them whenever I could steal a minute. So I was already stealing time from my family, and I was stealing time from work. I was stealing time from everything just so that I could write. I just had to do it, and there was no reason. Like, when I was a kid, I didn't want to be a writer. I never wrote.
But you were a big reader, right?
I was always a big reader, yeah. Big reader. Loved comic books and sci-fi and horror and adventure. But all of a sudden, I just started writing in my early 20s, and it kind of took over everything.
Wow.
And my wife said, well, look, you don't pay any attention to me. You don't pay any attention to the house. You don't pay any attention to the kids. You don't seem to care too much about your job. All you want to do is read and write. So why don't you try to actually do it for a living? And I was like, you're crazy. You know, you're nuts.
Did she have a good job?
No, she had a shitty job.
Oh, really?
We just had, our son had just been born then. He was a newborn. And she had a job in foster care in Brooklyn during the beginning of the crack epidemic. It was a terrible job. So she was all burnt out on that, and I was pretty much done with engineering. And Grumman was sort of downsizing at that time. And so we said, the aerospace on the East Coast is kind of dying. Let's make the jump. And so we took our savings, and we sold the house, and we went up to Cornell, and I got an MFA at Cornell. Cornell. So for 2.5 years there, I could consider myself a writer, which I'd never considered myself before. I considered myself sort of an amateur dabbling at it in the basement in my spare time. So I took myself super, super seriously up there and listened to everything everybody had to say as if it were gospel, and read as many books as I possibly could and wrote as much as I possibly could while I was up there. Because at the time I was almost 30 years old. And I was like, oh my gosh, life is passing me by. I've wasted all this time. I need to sort of get after it. And so I really applied myself, which meant, again, stealing the time from everybody around me. I got a lot of work done, but I felt really bad about it.
It gave you the time that you needed to really focus on it. So is your first book, Transmission, did that happen to be your MFA?
No, that's just a short story. That's actually just a little chapbook.
Okay.
And that's when I was sort of digging into the surrealists and the dadaists and also the French New Novelists. So it's sort of this spiral type thing. But it's just a story.
But it didn't come out of the MFA program.
No. So. No, that didn't come out. And a lot of the early stories don't come out of the MFA program either. I wrote a lot of those in my basement. When I wrote a drawer novel in my basement, it was like 690 pages.
A drawer novel? Put it in the drawer and it never came out?
It's in the drawer. There's one copy of it left, and I think right now it's at Cornell in my papers there. And I'm always tempted to just sneak in and burn the damn thing. It's so stultifyingly dull. It's awful. But
so your first successful book then was In the Walled City, right?
Yeah.
Your collection of short stories. I know one of those stories, Finding Amy, I think, ended up being the impetus for your first novel, published novel.
Yeah, because that story didn't work as a story. There was too many people and it was overpopulated, and I realized I hadn't told their stories yet.
Yeah, you really didn't.
And it was way too cold. It was third person, very distant, and I needed something warmer there. And so once I found my narrator, I said, this has got to be first person. I got to warm this thing up. So I found Arthur Parkinson, and once I found him, everything kind of fell into place, and it went very easily. But that was the fourth novel that I finished.
The
first to be published. Yeah, my master's thesis never got published. I think there's two copies in the Cornell Library somewhere. Boy, I love that book. It was terrible. But, you know.
Which, that quote, that it's impossible for you to write a bad novel, I heard you say twice, once tonight right before, and then yesterday. That's not true.
Well, the secret of writing is that you write badly every day.
Yeah.
You write terribly every day. I mean, your draft work is just god-awful. The sentences that you're trying to get down are awful, but you try to make them better little by little by little. It takes a long time to make them better. That's what I learned from John Gardner when I was researching that book of his on writers and writing. I was looking at his manuscripts up at the University of Rochester and just seeing how many drafts he did and how those early drafts are, they're just god-awful. He's a terrible, terrible line writer. But then as he's working on them, it gets better and better and deeper and more powerful and more concentrated until you get that end result, which is Grendel, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous book filled with some of the great, great poetry. But if you looked at the first draft, you're like, wow, that's terrible. How did he ever go on with it? How did he have the faith to keep going? And that just taught me that I needed to work a lot harder and to not worry so much about getting it down the first time perfect and to just get it down, get something there, move it around. You can always make it better. And that's what I try to tell aspiring writers. And that's what I try to tell myself day by day, because I'm like, wow, I really wrote like crap today. But at least I wrote. And I can make it better tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. It's just patience.
This is New Letters on the Air, and we're at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza with Stuart Onan, the Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence at UMKC, and we're really glad to have you here. So that makes me wonder about your writing process. Are you really disciplined? Do you do it every morning, or are you a night writer? What do you do?
When I'm home, I try to work 9 to 5 when I'm working on a book.
The whole day?
Well, it's like I don't have another job. I've got to produce something. And 9 to 5, and the goal is to get one page double-spaced. So that's 300 words. And sometimes you get that, sometimes you get a little bit more. It's rare that I fall short of that. I think Stephen King writes, I think he says 3 pages a day. Joyce Carol Oates does something like 5 pages a day. And those are my rabbits out ahead of me. I'm like, oh, I know that he's working today. I know she's working today. You know, I should be working today. What excuse do I have? You know, this is what I want to do with my life. I have the privilege of doing it. I need to get after it. So I get that page, and you can't expect it to be good. Sometimes it feels good when it goes down, when it goes into the machine and it comes out, you think, oh, wow, this is great. Then you look at it later that night and you're like, it's got to go. It's no good. That's no good. That's no good. And just keep moving it forward. Keep pushing it forward.
So you spend the first part of the day writing and then later you start the editing, or are you one of these that edits as you go?
No, I have a terrible habit of editing as I go. I'd rather just leave it down and crunchy, but I'm compulsive, so I always sort of get after it and try to smooth it out and make it right, which is dumb because you're going to have to break it later. You have to crack it open later and mess around with it. But actually, I get this sort of panic and hit sort of a hot streak, usually around 4 or 4:30. Yeah, right when I'm about to shut down at 5, suddenly I'm like, okay, I'm going to get something down here. And one more sentence, and that turns into maybe two more sentences, and maybe another scene, or maybe an opening, or maybe some notes to what's going on tomorrow. And when you've written, even if you've written poorly, it feels so much better than when you haven't written. It could suck, right? It could be terrible. It could be awful. You don't know. You try to finish the book and get it to your first readers and let them tell you, is it good? Is it bad? Is it mediocre? And chances are it's not going to be great. It's like batting. If you hit 300, you go into the Hall of Fame.
Well, let's go back to Snow Angels, which was that first novel that ended up doing really, really well. You won an award. I think it was a bestseller. It became a movie.
Yeah. David Gordon Green wrote a really great script and was also the director. So he got the tone was really, really well done. It was his vision. I was afraid that it was going to be god-awful because I've had friends have bad experiences with their adaptations. And I was watching it, and I was like, wow, it's all over the place. It's like going this way, and it's going that way. And then about halfway through, the sort of the storylines merged. And I was like, oh, right, that's how it works. That's how the novel goes. So I was like, oh, duh. And I was like, wow, it's really a great line, That's an amazing line. I was thinking, oh, I must be a wonderful writer. Most of the good lines in the film are his. And they're really good, too. I'm like, that's really good. So,
and he was the screenwriter as well as the
director. Screenwriter and the director.
Yeah.
It was one of his last sort of serious movies before he went on that streak of Pineapple Express and Eastbound and Down and sort of that stoner comedy stuff that he was doing with Danny McBride, which is really, really good stuff. So it's kind of weird to go from that heavy, serious, countryfied tragedy of Snow Angels into this breezy Seth Rogen and James Franco, basically. He gave James Franco his huge, huge break in Pineapple Express, which he got an Oscar nomination for Pineapple Express, which is nuts when you think about it. But he also did great work with Zooey Deschanel in All the Real Girls. That's her first great, great role. So he brings some really good stuff out of his actors.
Speaking of screenplays, you did one called Poe, but it was really for collectors, and it was about Edgar Allan Poe, and you like that whole horror genre. I mean, you've borrowed from it a bit, but tell me about that screenplay. That seemed odd to publish something that never got produced. Was it even considered for production?
No, it was never even submitted anywhere. I was up at the McDowell Colony in the woods, and I had a little cabin in the woods that I wrote in, and I'd gone up there to finish, I think it was Speed Queen that I finished up there, and I finished it early. And so by the time that I got to McDowell, I had nothing really to work on. And so I thought, what am I going to do up here in the middle of the woods? And I sort of glommed onto this edition of Poe's letters. And I started reading about Poe's life, and I was like, well, this is really fascinating. I'd love to make a gothic horror movie out of this. And so I just started writing a screenplay about Poe. And I typically do that. After I finish up a novel, I'll sort of clear the pipes out by writing a screenplay. And usually it's associated somehow
with
the book.
So that's not your first screenplay. You've written others?
No, I've written a bunch of others.
Really?
And usually I'll just take a book that I really love that I think could use a little work. Going After Cacciato, Tim O'Brien, I wrote a screenplay to that after I finished my Vietnam novel, The Names of the Dead. The Violent Barred Away by Flannery O'Connor, which you can't get the rights to it. I mean, her will states that no one is going to make a movie of this. So I figured, I'll just do it and have fun with it. It's a way of inhabiting the books. I mean, down to the dialogue and the scenes and the gestures that the characters make. And to try to make it a little stronger, I guess. The Lynchers by John Edgar Wideman, if you've ever read it. It's one of his early novels in which these four black men decide they're going to lynch a white cop. Just on principle there. And they never sort of get to it, not to give it away, but the arguments that they have, why we should do this or why we shouldn't do this, and how it sort of tears them apart as friends. It's a fascinating book. And so I sort of wrote a screenplay based on that, but taking it even a step further.
Wow. Weideman, isn't he from Pittsburgh as
he
well?
He is. He's one of the great, great Pittsburgh writers.
Right.
Yeah, but he's like living in France. He's living somewhere somewhere way fancier.
But you were born in Pittsburgh and are still there.
Born and raised, yeah. And I boomeranged. I went away for 30 years but came back there. And everyone's still there. My family is all there. I'm the only one that ever left, which again is very typical of Pittsburgh.
That fascinates me that you write those screenplays. Talk about being in conversation with a writer. That really is taking it to a different degree. Do you show them to anybody?
Sure. I'll send them to the writers. I wrote one of Dennis Johnson's first novel, Angels, and I had him read it. And then I met him later on. He was talking about it. And it's like, this is cool. Dennis Johnson talking about Angels. He'd actually written a screenplay of Angels and sold it to Hollywood. They never made the movie, so they just shoved it in a drawer and it's never been seen.
Yeah.
But I got
happens with a lot of screenplays.
Oh, tons. I mean, Hollywood's so goofy, but I just had fun writing them, and they don't take very long to write. They may take, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And to go through a book like The Violent Barrett Away and say, what do I have to show to the viewer to really get them to understand this very, very odd story? It's a lot of fun.
It's a great exercise for you as a writer, too. Talk about learning from them as well.
And again, just digging a little deeper into the books.
That's Stuart Onan, and this is New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library, as he is the Cockafera Chair Writer in Residence at UMKC. And since we're talking about screenplays, that might be a good shift into West of Sunset, your book looking at F. Scott Fitzgerald during his Hollywood years, and he's trying his hand at screenplay writing out in Hollywood. Do you want to talk a little bit about that book?
Yeah,
I'd
love to.
I'm going to have you read from it, I think.
Love to. Yeah, it was fascinating to me because in the biographies of Fitzgerald, they give a sort of short shrift, and they can't set the scenes as fully as I'd like them to be. He lived at the Garden of Allah at the same time that Dorothy Parker and Alan Campbell lived there, and Humphrey Bogart and Mayo Methot, his second wife at the time, was his girlfriend there. And all these other people, Ogden Nash lived there, and Robert Benchley, and Donald Ogden Stewart. So he had friends there, and he'd come from the East. He was broke. Zelda was in the asylum in North Carolina. He was drinking. He wasn't really writing much fiction at all. I mean, he'd failed. In life, he had failed at this point, and this was going to be his last stop, to come out in Hollywood and try to make it. And this was his third time out there. He'd failed twice there before. So this time he goes out, and he has to get out of debt because he owes Harold Ober, his agent, something like $30,000. In Depression-era value there.
And he's been promising him a novel. And
he's been promising that. Well, he owes Max a novel.
Yeah.
He owes him a novel.
Yeah.
And so when he runs out of money, what he does is he'll end up hawking his car to just keep going. So he's got very little margin for error here, and he goes out there and he tries to redeem himself the only way he knows how, which is to work and work and work. And he goes out there and he falls in love. And he works at MGM at the same time on the same hallway where Dorothy Parker, Aldous Huxley, and James M. Cain, you know, and then this new kid, Fitzgerald, who doesn't know what the hell he's doing there. So he goes there, a total failure, and he's surrounded by people who are at or about to have the pinnacle of their success. Dorothy Parker and Alan Campbell have just won the Oscar for A Star is Born. Humphrey Bogart is getting great reviews and is about to become this iconic guy, and Aldous Huxley has just won an Oscar for Pride and Prejudice, you know, and MGM is the prestige studio. So he's on the lot while they're making The Wizard of Oz. He works actually on Gone with the Wind, which I didn't know when I started writing the book, and I found that out. He actually works for 2 weeks with David O. Selznick, who's popping amphetamines and staying up all night and just going through writers. So it seemed fascinating to me, this very broken down romantic figure in one of the most romantic eras and romantic places in American history, surrounded by the Depression, his depression, the alcoholism. And in the midst of all this, he ends up having to go back to do these weird vacations with Zelda that her doctor has prescribed. And he prescribes them, go for
because
a week.
Because she's in a sanitarium.
She's in a sanitarium and mostly will be for the rest of her life. But the doctor thinks it's good to acclimate herself to the outside world. So she sends Zelda and Scott and their daughter Scotty off on these week-long vacations to places like Myrtle Beach or Virginia Beach or Miami or Cuba.
Because she's in Tryon or Henderson Hills, somewhere
near Asheville,
south of Asheville.
Yeah, just outside of Asheville there at Highland Hospital. So these
in North Carolina, by the way.
These very odd vacations that He picks himself up from his writing and from his romancing of Sheila Graham, his new love, and goes back east, and it always turns out badly. And then he always sort of goes back on the bottle then, and he goes back and says, Sheila, help me. And after a while, Sheila's like, yeah, I don't want to deal with this. So he has to sort of pick himself up all over again. And meanwhile, he's working and working and working and smoking and taking pills and in terrible health. And in the biographies, they can't put you there. They can't put you at the Garden of Allah during the parties. They can't show you him talking to Hemingway when Hemingway comes to town, and he's the toast of the town, and Scott has, like, nothing there. And I wanted those scenes. I wanted to feel, what does it feel like to be him going through this? And that's always the question for me in writing fiction. How does it feel to be you? And luckily, with Fitzgerald, there's lots of evidence there. You know, there's the books, there's the letters, there's other people's biographies and views of him. So I could get a rounded view of Fitzgerald and work with him. So it was very much more editorial in deciding what needs to go in the book to understand who he is and what I can sort of leave out.
Well, Stuart Onan, would you like to give us a taste of this book, West of Sunset?
Well, I will open up with the first section, which is Chimney Rock, and doesn't need any setup, but the epigraphs for the book are, there are no second acts in American lives. And a lot of people think that this is actually from The Last Tycoon, but it's not. It's from an earlier essay called My Lost City, in which he thinks about how he has lost that early success, and he wrote this in 1932, and how also America has lost that success, having crashed in 1929. This is a second epigraph is from Crazy Sunday, his short story about Hollywood. Nothing was impossible. Everything was just beginning. That spring, he holed up in the Smokies, in a tired resort hotel by the asylum, so he could be closer to her. A bout of pneumonia over Christmas had provoked a flare-up of his TB, and he was still recovering. The mountain air was supposed to help. Days he wrote in his bathrobe, drinking Coca-Cola to keep himself going, holding off on the gin till nightfall, a small point of pride, sipping on the dark veranda as couples strolled among the fireflies rising from the golf course. Outside of town, Highland Hospital crowned the ridgeline, a spired Gothic palace in the clouds, worthy of a bewitched princess. He couldn't afford it, as he couldn't afford the other private clinics they'd tried, but he pleaded poverty and hashed out a discount with the trustees, begging the money from his agent, an onerous form of credit, borrowing against stories he'd yet to imagine. He had no choice. At Pratt, they left her too much alone. She'd strangled herself with a ripped pillowcase, nearly succeeding, the livid band across her windpipe a reminder. One night while she was strapped to her bed, the Archangel Michael appeared, glowing, and told her the world would end unless she could move the seven nations to repent. She took to wearing white and memorizing the Bible. In her paintings, the faceless damned writhed in fire. At Highland, her new doctor believed in diet and exercise. No cigarettes, no sweets. Every day the patients hiked a prescribed distance, sturdy nurses spurring them on like coaches. She lost weight, her skin tinted over her cheekbones, her nose a blade, recalling that awful year in Paris. She whittled her body down, trying to remake herself for the ballet. Yet not manic, not frenzied like then, her knees bruised black, feet cracked from practice. After her insulin treatments, she was calm, subdued by sheer lack of energy. Instead of sinners, she painted flowers, big, blousy blooms just as corrupt. She could sleep now, she said, a mercy he envied. Her cursive returned, neat lines running like waves down the page instead of the bunched, slanted hand he'd come to dread. With Zelda, everything was a test. For their anniversary, they were allowed to take a day trip to Chimney Rock. He was to be both husband and chaperone, charged with cataloging her conduct, speech, and intake. Observations he registered automatically, yet resented sharing, as if, after so long in captivity, they had a shred of privacy left. It was a balmy Sunday, the dogwoods frilled with pink, the visitor's lot busy with gussied-up loved ones toting picnic baskets. Dr. Carroll himself delivered her to the front desk, handing her over to Scott like a doting father. In her 20s, baby-faced and petite, she'd seemed girlish. She'd been an athlete and a dancer, a notorious flirt, her stamina and fearlessness irresistible. Now, just shy of 37, she was pinched and haggard, crone-like, her smile ruined by a broken tooth. Some well-meaning soul had fixed her hair for the occasion, gathering the unruly honey blonde mop back into a knitted black snood which sat cat-like on one shoulder, a style he'd seen on shop girls and waitresses, but one she would never choose, especially since it made her face even sharper, hawkish. The carmine sundress was an old favorite, though it had faded from hard washing and hung on her, robe-like, the yoke of her collarbone hollowed, a sheer scarf knotted like a choker to conceal her throat. When he leaned down to greet her, she turned her face into his, her lips grazing his cheek. "Thank you," she said, pulling away as if he'd done her a favor. "Happy anniversary." "Oh, Dodo, happy anniversary." It always surprised him to hear her soft Dixie lilt coming from this wizened stranger, as if hiding somewhere inside his fresh, wild Zelda still existed. The doctor congratulated them. "How many years is it?" 17, she said, looking to Scott to check her math. 17 years, he confirmed, nodding, uncertain if this fact was happy. The number was as illusory as their marriage. As his wife, she'd now been hospitalized as long as not, and in fretful moments, the question of whether she'd been mad all along and he attracted to that madness unsettled him. "Enjoy yourselves," the doctor said. "Oh, we will," she said, and took Scott's hand, squeezing it as they walked through the vaulted lobby and out into the bright day, relinquishing it only when he opened the car door and helped her in like a footman. On her seat rested a present he'd bought at the hotel gift shop. "Dodo, really, you needn't have." As he closed the door, he palmed the knob, silently locking it. "It's nothing, a token. And here I didn't get you anything." She didn't wait, shucking the paper to reveal a shallow candy box. "Oh, this is what I think it is. You devil. You know I can't resist peanut brittle. Pecan brittle. Oh, it's lovely, darling, but I don't think it's allowed." "I promise not to tell." "You'll have to help me then, to dispose of the evidence." "Precisely." How quickly they were conspirators, as if it were their natural state. Together, in another age, they'd been famous for their fashionable trespasses, the stuff of magazine covers and scandal sheets. And perhaps because his fall had been less spectacular and far less punitive, at times like these, a nostalgic guilt pricked him, as if, impossible as it was, he should have saved her.
Stuart Onan at the Kansas City Public Library, reading from his 15th novel, West of Sunset, when he was UMKC's 2017 Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence. In another show, he reads from his next novel, City of Secrets, and talks about Henry himself, his 2019 novel in his Pittsburgh trilogy, and shares his thoughts on the 2018 Squirrel Hill Massacre. Just search for Stuart Onan at newletters.org, and you'll discover he was the judge for Bookmark Press's G.S. Sharat Chandra Prize for Short Fiction. That collection, Stone Skimmers by Jennifer Wisner Kelly, is now out. If you have a book manuscript to submit, the writing contest for poetry and short stories is open until January 15th at newletters.org under the Bookmark Books tab. You can also help our literary efforts by supporting New Letters. To keep up with our news and events, follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram. A production of UMKC's New Letters magazine, today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Ashley Cote, Jordan Hooper, Evan Lohman, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.